Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. This is episode 68, hosted by Marty Jones, produced by Owen Woods. And we have no guest for today, but we do have plenty to speak about. So Owen and I will be having a conversation a little bit later on. We had hoped to visit with Aaron Lasky, outfitter and backcountry guide extraordinaire. But fortunately for Aaron, and unfortunately for us, Aaron got booked for duty in what is a very busy fall season for SLV outdoor guides. That's good for the out of doors, and we hope to be able to catch up with Aaron later on in the fall. I did go on my own cycling tour over three states that I'll talk about some later in this episode. We'll also visit with our own Owen Woods about the tragic deaths of two out-of-state hunters during a lightning storm in the Rio Grande National Forest earlier in September. What should you do if you're hunting or hiking or walking in the woods when a storm arrives? We'll talk to Owen, an experienced backpacker and former volunteer in search and rescue operations, about all of that later. And in this episode, we'll hear about the 2-3-2 partnership and the efforts to protect two watersheds, three river corridors in two states, Colorado and New Mexico. Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, talked to Andrea Jones, the Rio Grande National Forest Caneos District Ranger, and Adam Moore, local Colorado State Forester, among others, about the work of this dual-state, multi-agency effort to address the inevitability of wildfires in our backyard. But first, a bit of news and some calendar items. So we have a three-month outlook for weather. There has been some hope that the rains of September would translate into a wet and stormy falls. Official forecasts from NOAA show the opposite. October and November through mid-December are expected to bring above normal temperatures and below normal precipitation for the San Luis Valley. And you can learn more about that by visiting Alamosa Citizen. It looks like the federal government will be shutting down for a period of time come Wednesday. That's because, as of this recording, Tuesday afternoon, Congress has not yet come to an agreement on funding for the federal government's new fiscal year that begins October 1. In the event of a shutdown, it is likely that the Visitor's Center and other ranger-led activities at the Great Sand Dunes National Park will come to a halt. However, access to the national park should continue since there are no true physical barriers to prevent the public from accessing the National Park and Preserve and other federal BLM assets in the area. Similarly, the Monte Vista and Alamosa Wildlife Refuges should remain accessible to trail users, birders, and outdoor adventurers, again, because there are no true barriers to close off public access. The 5th Annual True Penitence Climbing Festival is October 3rd through 5th at Penitente Canyon. This annual climbing festival and competition is hosted by the SLV Climbers Alliance and put on every year when the sun hits the rock walls at Penitente just right. You can find more information on event details, how to sign up, how to volunteer, and what routes the competition will take place on at slvclimb.org. And if you go back to listen to a previous podcast, we had an interview with the SLV Climbers Alliance on the Outdoor Citizen, and you can get more information from that as well. San Luis Valley Ecosystem Council has a trifecta celebration planned for Saturday, November 8th. It's been 25 years since the passage of the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve Act. 25 years since the creation of a category of public lands called National Conservation Lands, and 25 years of council leadership by Christine Canale. Now that's a trifecta worth celebrating. The event on November 8th is from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Dunes Valley Distillery in Mosca, Colorado. Please let the SLV Ecosystem Council know you're coming by registering at the link in the SLV Outdoor Report on alamosacitizen.com. And now we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. You're listening to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. We'll be right back.
AlamosaCitizen.com was launched in August 2021 to provide a fresh perspective on the San Luis Valley. We are guided by the idea that engaged citizenship matters to the individual and to the community. You can support our work by going to AlamosaCitizen.com and hit support our work and give what you can. We appreciate it. We cannot do this work without your support. Thank you, and we'll see you around the valley.
All right, well, welcome back to the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. I just want to talk a little bit about some cycling adventures that I've had. Not really extraordinary adventures, but some cycling events just in the last couple of weeks. And going back even further than that. Because this year, this summer, well, actually this September, I got a chance to ride a couple of rail trails, the Mickelson Trail in South Dakota and the Katy Trail in Missouri. Before I talk about those, you might be wondering what a rail trail is. Well, essentially, it's a multi-use public path built along former railroad corridors. Because it's a railroad grade, it's pretty flat. If there is an incline, it's generally no more than 2 to 4%. And most rail trails are open to walking, running, cycling, mountain biking, cross-country skiing, horseback riding. Many of them are suitable for wheelchair use. And some of them are suitable for a road bike route use as well. There's more than 2,100 rail trails all across the United States, and you can learn more about it by visiting the website for the Rail Trail Conservancy. And I have a book in front of me, the Rail Trail Hall of Fame, which is a selection of premier rail trails through the United States. There's only 33 listed in this book out of the 2,100. Of the 33 that are listed in here, two of them are ones that I was able to ride on this summer. The Mickelson Trail is in South Dakota in the Black Hills area. It's the southern terminus is Edgemont, South Dakota. And the northern terminus is Deadwood. And it's about 100, it's a little over 100 miles long altogether. I got a chance to ride from the Mystic access point to Custer. And that's a distance of about 31 miles. From Mystic to Hill City, a distance of a little over 15 miles. There's a gentle grade up and then a gentle grade down. And from Hill City to Custer, it's the same thing. A gentle grade up and then a gentle grade down into Custer. It's a beautiful trail. The surface is essentially road-based packed gravel. Even though that it had rained the night before, drainage was good, so we didn't have to ride through any puddles. It's smooth enough that I did see some riders on road bikes, but the vast majority were on either mountain bikes or gravel bikes. And there e-bikes are permitted on the trail. There's wildlife. We saw deer. We saw plenty of bird activity. And at the end of the trail, at the access point for the trail in Hill City, South Dakota, there's a nice little microbrewery that had some pretty tasty beer, just what we needed because it was pretty hot when we were in South Dakota. And, you know, that's one of the benefits of the rail trails themselves is that they have an economic boon or benefit to the communities through which the rail trail runs. I encourage you to go out and check out some of the rail trails that are possible. Later on that same trip, we were in Missouri, and I got a chance to ride a short distance on the Katy Trail. The Katy Trail follows the railroad corridor for the old Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, the MKT, better known as the Katy. You may have heard of this railroad if you're a fan of the Blues Brothers, because they have a song about, "She got the Katy and left me a mule to ride." Well, that Katy they're talking about is the Katy Railroad. So the Katy Trail, just like any other rail trail, has a very slight grade to it, mostly flat. And one of the really cool things about the Katy Trail, much of the Katy Trail runs alongside the Missouri River. And although we tend to think of parts of Missouri as being flat, along the river, there are some pretty high bluffs. And unlike the Rio Grande, which is not so grande here in the San Luis Valley, at least not in terms of water, the Missouri is a pretty big river. There's lots of water. And so it's really beautiful. And it's heavily wooded, so you can always see plenty of birds. If you're lucky, you might get to see some foxes and rabbits. I did hear, as I was riding, some crashing in the trees alongside the trail. I think there may have been some deer or other animals along there. Many of these rail trails, because they're following railroad corridors, actually have tunnels, some of which are pretty short, some of which may be longer. The section of the Mickelson Trail that I rode had three railroad tunnels, and the Katy Trail had one railroad tunnel. And that's always kind of neat to ride through the tunnels and get light at the end of the tunnel. So I encourage you to check out some of the rail trails. And if you're interested, one of the closest ones to us is called the Rio Grande Trail. You might suspect that that would follow along the Rio Grande River. It does not. It follows a corridor of the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad running from Glenwood Springs to Aspen. And that trail is completely paved. It was a part of a route of Ride the Rockies that I did several years ago. Very suitable for road bikes. If you're a Hunter Thompson fan, it runs right through Woody Creek, and you can stop at the Woody Creek Tavern and have a beer or something more stout than a beer if you wish. One other rail trail that I've ridden on was about 3 years ago in central Minnesota called the Heartland Trail, which was really kind of fun because about every 6 to 8 miles, it went right through a little community. And those communities are set up to accommodate the riders with snack bars and drink establishments and candy stores and souvenir shops and all sorts of things. The rail trails are a fun way to spend a few days. Many of the trails have their own guidebook. Many of the trails have organized rides once or twice a year. There are several cycling outfitters that will provide a guided trip. If you do the Katy Trail, for example, that's the longest rail trail in the U.S. It's about 240 miles running from Clinton, Missouri to just north of St. Louis. And the outfitters for the Katy Trail will transport all your gear, your luggage. They will even make arrangements for you to stay at B&Bs or hotels or what have you on the way. So it's a really fun way to see the United States in a variety of locations. The other ride that I'm going to talk about just a little bit is a ride that I just completed this past weekend called the Chili Pepper Challenge down in El Paso, New Mexico. And it's a road bike ride. I did the Metric Century route, but because of rain the night before, some of the route had to be altered because of flooded. I chose to ride the Metric Century route, which is nominally 62.5 miles. However, because of rain the night before, the route had to be shortened by a couple of miles because of flooded roadways. It was a fun ride, well attended. There were between 300 and 400 riders altogether, choosing distances that the longest was the metric century, but there was a 40-mile route and a 25-mile route and a 5-mile route for kids. Good snacks, well organized, marked very well. So it was just an excellent ride. Great weather. We didn't get rained on. We didn't get bombarded by excess heat. Just a very pleasant, fun ride. So if you ever get a chance, if you want to do an organized ride out of the valley, drive down the Rio Grande corridor all the way to El Paso. Next year, it'll be the last Sunday in September, and join me for a ride on that. It's a nice benefit ride for cancer relief in the El Paso area. Let's talk a little bit about this hunter safety and being safe in a lightning storm and outdoor storm.
And the reason we're bringing this up early in September, two hunters, both 25 years old, Andrew Porter and Ian Stesko, were declared missing in the Rio Grande National Forest in the Trujillo Meadows area. Well, a week later, they were both found dead. They were both killed by a lightning strike, which was, the Canales County coroner said their deaths were immediate. They were instantly killed. But they were both found under a tree. There was a pretty gnarly storm that rolled through there, and I actually spoke to a local who said the storms Thursday night and Friday night, the nights that these two were declared missing, were a nightmare. All night long, lightning storms. And so we thought it would be a good idea to kind of, you know, recap on the fact that these two guys really did nothing wrong, except for maybe not checking the weather, but even then you can't really fault them for that. This was a lightning strike, and it's rough. It's a rough way to go, but again, it was quick. But we thought it would be a good idea to kind of talk about kind of lightning safety in general and just general preparedness for the backcountry, because we're the third highest state for lightning deaths in the country, which is pretty substantial because the other two states are Florida and Texas. States well, with lots of lightning.
More lightning than we get.
The reason for us is lots of tall trees, lots of mountains, lots of people out in the summertime when big storms roll through. I think the important thing to kind of top this all off is that really nowhere is truly safe from lightning. You know, indoors and metal-topped containers are better because they can disperse that lightning, but really at the end of the day, it's a lightning strikes the ground at temperatures hotter than the surface of the sun. You know, it's a guaranteed danger every single year. If there's a thunderstorm, you're in danger.
Well, and lightning causes so many of our wildfires also.
It's true. Lightning can strike way more than once in one spot, and it can be very violent. I've been in some pretty crazy thunderstorms in these mountains, and it's not a place I want to be.
You know? Have you been close enough that the hair raised on the back of your head?
A couple of times I've been in the lower alpine, you know, right around 11,500, 12,000 feet, and there's been a couple times where the hair on the back of my neck and my arms have stood straight up, and it's not a comfortable feeling.
No, and you need to take measures to get away from that as soon as you can.
Yep. Yeah, there's a few things you can do in the backcountry that can lower your risk, but the best thing you can do is to check before you even go and to see if there's any kind of weather rolling in. I think that if you're familiar with the San Grays and the San Juans in a normal summer, normally you want to start your day early and be off that mountain by noon. Not every day is like that. Again, you know, check the weather before you go, but you know, kind of the rule of thumb, especially in the San Grays, is you really shouldn't be up in those mountains after noon, or at least in a place where thunderstorms can be especially dangerous. When you're up above alpine and you're on the weather side of a mountain, it's probably the last place on earth you want to be.
Yeah, I remember doing a hike with a friend. I believe that we were trying to summit Yale up in the Collegiate Peaks, and we got partway up and it looked like a storm was coming in. We turned around and left. And my friend remarked, "The mountain will be there the next time."
Yep.
You want to be there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've made that decision plenty of times. The weather looks good in the morning and then it all of a sudden doesn't look good, but you know what, the mountain will be there tomorrow. I'll be sore tomorrow, but I won't be dead tomorrow.
Right, exactly. Is there, when you're up above timberline, there are no trees to get under.
Right.
So that's not an issue. But if you can't get down below timberline, is there some place you can seek shelter?
You know, the National Weather Service and NOAA, they have a really interesting kind of guide on, it's a 0 to 10 rating of the most dangerous places to the safest possible. And obviously your most dangerous places are going to be the mountain peaks, you know, at the summit. That's the last place you want to be with a backpack and a hiking pole. But as you come down, you know, in higher risk areas, you know, kind of as you descend, lower groups of trees that are not very small or isolated, kind of uniform forests, are safer than just single isolated trees. Big isolated trees that go way up, those are going to be your lightning rods. That's where you don't want to be. And as a matter of fact, that's where they found both of these hunters, next to an isolated tree. You want to make yourself as low as possible without lying on the ground. As you disperse your surface area over the ground, it makes you more likely to be struck from the ground.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so you don't want to lay flat on the ground. You essentially want to get as low as you possibly can while maintaining just your feet on the ground if you can. Your chances of being struck are still high, but you're not going to be such a target. Now, if you're in a group, what they recommend in a group is that you all spread out at least 100 feet apart from each other, not because it's likelier to dissipate the energy, but it's likelier to hit just one of you. And if it hits one of you, you prevent mass casualties. You can look at some instances, particularly of cows, large fields of cows, it strikes one and it spreads to everybody else. So if you're in a group in the backcountry and there's a thunderstorm, spread out so that in case one of you gets hit, there are other people who can help you, which again is it's not the best advice, but it's, again, there's very little you can do when there's nothing around to protect you. Your best, most safest option for surviving is to check the weather the day before, is to not be in that area at all. But again, it's Colorado, weather's going to be,
it changes frequently.
Yes. And especially in big mountain ranges like the Sangres and in the Blanca Massif, that tend to kind of create their own weather systems and their own patterns and can be different from the valley floor by miles, by temperatures, by entirely different weather systems on the same day. So yeah, again, knowing before you go is always going to be my go-to piece of advice, is that you should always be prepared for everything and anything.
Good advice. And that holds true whether you're, however you are recreating, if you are hiking, if you're biking, if you're hunting, if you're fishing, especially if you're fishing and you're using a graphite rod, don't stand out in the middle of the river when there's a storm going on. You've got a lightning rod in your hand. All right. Anything else about that, Owen?
You know, nothing too crazy. I would just say that if you're hiking, you know, any weather app that uses national weather data is going to be good for you to check. And then, you know, NOAA and weather.gov, they have a lot of resources on lightning and what you can do to prevent lightning strikes or to keep yourself safe. I think at the end of the day, it's just keeping an eye on the weather and making decisions that might be difficult to make, but are in the end going to save you, because nothing is worth dying over ego for, you know. Really isn't.
Very good advice. Next, let's hear from the 232 Council with Andrea Jones. First, we'll hear how the partnership got started more than 6 years ago.
Actually, Adam and I were two of the original founders of the 232.
So you had the foresight to understand the problems, the complexities of this region, of the watersheds, the rivers between two states, Adam. You had that foresight to say we should start coordinating, planning things here.
Yeah, I would definitely put it further than just Andrea and I. I mean, the partners in New Mexico, the Nature Conservancy, New Mexico Forestry, even partners on the San Juan side because of how the San Juan River provides water down to Albuquerque. It was a whole group of us that understood and saw the needs in this part of Colorado and New Mexico.
We noticed that a lot of us who were land managers had goals in common. And so, for example, we had the spruce beetle die-off. where all the mature spruce trees are dying off on private lands and on public lands. And we're trying to think about uses for that wood, for that biomass. We were also talking about fire across the landscape and, you know, how fire might travel from different land management boundaries and how we were going to work together.
Now we'll hear about the work of the 232 Partnership in coordinating land management practices across the two states, three rivers, and two watersheds.
Give us some sense of the threats, Andrea, that you're working through. Do you, for example, imagine or tabletop some of these exercises? Are they just conversations? Give us some idea of how you see this.
So the 232, actually, that's another thing we have momentum on, is modeling across the landscape to see where the highest risk areas are. And then we're also able, kind of like, you know, Lily mentioned, to bring some funding into the landscape to treat high priority areas. And so that's what we, you know, are sort of focused on, is where can we have the best impact on the landscape.
The 232 has a lot of people to look after. Here's how they look at private landowners and communities who are in the path of wildfire.
I guess from the Forest Service perspective, I'll speak that, you know, we focus a lot on communities that are within that wildland-urban interface where, you know, people have built their homes basically in the forest. So they have the most direct risk generally when there is a wildfire. That being said, you know, as Lily alluded to, we have huge cities down south of this landscape that rely on the water that comes from these mountains. And so they should also be paying attention, and probably Lily could speak more to something like the Rio Grande Water Fund, where we are getting some funding back into these landscapes from those larger communities downstream.
Finally, we'll hear how the 232 group sees prescribed burns as a preventive measure.
Fire is going to be a part of the landscape at some point in time. And a lot of times, you know, we will see unhealthy areas that actually need fire in that ecosystem in order for that to be healthy in a healthy forest. Also, sometimes that's a really good tool, kind of in conjunction with what Adam's talking about, treating the private land. You know, we want to treat public lands adjacent. And that way, when a wildfire comes through, maybe it behaves differently because those fuels have already been treated before.
If you're interested in more information about the 232 partnership and the work that's going on there, you can listen to the full episode regarding the 232 podcast on the Valley Pod at alamosacitizen.com or wherever you get your podcasts, including on Apple and Spotify. And that ends this episode of the Outdoor Citizen podcast. Produced and edited by Owen Woods. Thank goodness he is such a good producer and editor. Published by alamosacitizen.com. You can listen to the show wherever you stream your podcasts. If you have an outdoor adventure you'd like to share, or if there are topics you'd like to hear about in a future episode, send an email to info@alamosacitizen.com. As always, we'd like to thank Don Richmond for his song Sea Turtle and Daniel Boyce for the sounds of the valley's birds. Until next time, this is Marty Jones saying get outside and enjoy this fall weather.
Are you looking for funding to launch a community project, program, or event in Monta Vista? The Lohr Foundation is here to help. Lohr supports projects that are designed and led by locals like you. The best part? There are no complicated applications, time-consuming reports, or grant cycle deadlines. All it takes to start a funding request is a simple conversation. So reach out to Monta Vista Community Officer Yvette Atencio at lorefoundation.org today and take the first step towards turning your idea into a reality.
¿Estás buscando financiamiento para lanzar un proyecto, programa o evento comunitario en Monta Vista? La Fundación LOR, L-O-R, está aquí para ayudarte. LOR apoya proyectos que son diseñados y liderados por personas locales como tú. La mejor parte, no hay solicitudes complicadas, informes que consumen mucho tiempo, ni fechas límite de convocatorias. Todo lo que necesitas para iniciar una solicitud de financiamiento es una conversación sencilla. Así que, comunícate hoy mismo con la oficial comunitaria de Monta Vista, Yvette Atencio, en lordfoundation.org. LORFOUNDATION.ORG. Y da el primer paso para convertir tu idea en una realidad.